There are a couple of names you ought to know. I've written them down here, lest I forget them. One is a man named Frederick Law Olmsted. You need to know that name. He's a guy who really began to see the place of parks in the city, to make cities livable. In 1857, he developed the first park for an urban community, and that is, of course, Central Park in New York. And what happened when the park was put into place is that the real estate immediately surrounding the park soared in value, and suddenly cities began to recognize the value of such a thing. In addition to that, it created a place of spontaneity and life in the city of New York. If you go to New York, you know that Central Park is a very vital and alive place, at least in the daytime. At night, it's another story. If you go to a city like Paris, or even a city like London, you will see that there are inner city parks. However, you will notice something about these parks that you don't notice about our parks, and that there are these huge fences around them. And that's because in those cities, parks were very elitist places. There were certain parks for the upper class, there were certain parks for the middle class, and there's certain, well, I don't think they did anything for the lower classes, but basically there were social distinctions in the parks you could go to. There are in the great paintings of the French Impressionists, particularly those who painted in Paris, pictures of them in the park, and these were great social gatherings, and these upper-class people would come almost formally dressed. Have you ever seen those, Renoir paintings where they're sitting in the park and they're all properly dressed, and people with hot hats, women with hats and gowns in the park. But this was a place where you came and gathered. And to a great degree, Olmsted thought that this is what should be replicated in the United States. But we weren't quite the kind of class-conscious society that the British and the French proved to be. One of the things that you should notice is that in the cities, they were very, very class-conscious. And it was different than in a rural community. In a rural community, everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows who's upper class, who's middle class, who's lower class. There's a distinction in those places. Well, what's even more is that there are even locations where people live. Davies, for instance, the great sociologist, said, in analyzing very small cities, you'll find that the rich people live up on the hill, on the top of the hill. And as you come down the hill, you tend to come to lower and lower class people until you get right to the riverside. Now, of course, people love to have houses on the river, but they used to have them on the hilltop. And it was a very distinct stratification system. I'll talk about one particular city in the United States in a classical study in just a minute or two. But please get this imagery of in a rural place or in a small town, people knew who was whom. In the large cities, you couldn't make these distinctions. And so you began to have class distinctions by the kind of hat you wore. Please note, if you were upper class, you wore a high hat. If you're middle class, you wore a ball hat. And if you were lower class, you wore a cap. And so simply by looking at a man, you could distinguish what social class he belonged to. When you say the British had a class-conscious society, I mean, this is class-conscious to the extent that you could be fined in London for wearing a hat of a class that was above your own. So if a lower-class guy wore a ball hat, he could be put in jail for that. I mean, this was ridiculous. Or if a middle-class person would wear a high hat, and incidentally, this was drilled into your head when you were a child. I mean, the old private schools, I shouldn't say old private school, they are still there. These very, if you think we have elitist schools here on the main line, you should try England, where you have Eton. And if you haven't gone to Eton, you haven't really distinguished yourself as being very, very much a part of a certain class. And the boys would wear these high hats. There's a wonderful photograph of in England that every British person has seen, where these boys are standing there waiting for a train to go back into London at the Eton train station. And these upper-class boys are dressed in formal dress. That's the way they went to school, formal dress with a high hat. And leaning on canes with great dignity. And these three working class boys with their caps over at the side laughing at them. It's a wonderful picture. I mean, but it demonstrates, and these upper class guys are looking at them with contempt. This class consciousness was very notable. And in the construction of these cities, that class consciousness was really built into the whole structure of the city. What kind of park are we going to have for the upper class? What kind of park are we going to have for the middle class? And of course, the lower class, they didn't get anything at all. Olmsted built Central Park, hoping that it would have a kind of cultural effect on New York. And indeed, it did. It had a very fine effect. In this respect, Philadelphia triumphed. There are very few places where Philadelphia triumphed. I pointed out that we were always the last to figure out what needed to be done. And when we introduced the innovation, it was usually too late to do the city any good. But in this respect, we are way ahead of the game. Olmsted also developed the Fairmount Park system in Philadelphia, the largest park system of any city in the world. You should recognize this. And what you really need to do as urban students is you need to take a walk someday down East River Drive. There's a wonderful walk, and you could, if you want to, you can go to the row of boathouses that are right at the end. And in the last boathouse, you can rent a bike, and you can ride up and down. It's very inexpensive, and you can ride. It's a wonderful bike ride. It's about 8 or 9 miles one way and back the other, and it's totally flat, and it's absolutely beautiful. But the thing that will amaze you is the beauty of that ride, and number two, the way in which the city has worked hard to put art all along that place. And I'm not talking about second-rate art. Some of the great sculptors of America have, in fact, put their artwork there, and the city has put a fortune into statuary there. Some of the most beautiful stuff you'll ever see anywhere in the world is along that. It's an art museum in and of itself. But it was Olmsted that developed this park system that runs all the way through the city. Get a map of Philadelphia out. My wife always is amused at me because I always love to study maps, because you have all kinds of things that you can learn from maps. And one of the things that stands out is this huge parking system that runs through the city. And you would never suspect when you're riding down East River Drive that 150 yards on the right is an extremely dilapidated slum. You would never guess that. But there you have it. Now, there are all kinds of parks in the Philadelphia park system. I lived very close to Cobbs Creek Park, which when I was a boy was a great place to go and play. But here we move into another phenomena. What remained for later sociologists to discover, because cities change, city life changes, the character of city life changes. When I was a boy, one of the great things you would do is go to the park to play. Now, that's the last place you want your kid to play, because parks have become very, very dangerous places. And may I say, drugs have had a great deal to do with all of this. So, where do kids play? Well, the answer is quite simple, and this isn't anything new. This goes back time immemorial in America. Kids play in the street. Now, you say, oh, this is terrible. Once again, the middle-class suburban bias. Poor kids, they have no place to play. They have to play out in the street. That's exactly where parents want their kids to play. Why? Because they can keep an eye on them. They can watch them. What's even more is the great study that was done called The Life and Death of the Great American Cities was that urban planners had this crazy idea that what you really ought to do is provide parks for kids. And that's exactly what you shouldn't provide. Here's a street. Here are the kids playing on the street. If some stranger shows up and starts messing with the kids, it's amazing in the inner city. people will come out of their houses and say, what are you doing here? What are you doing around here? They'll start asking the stranger, what are you doing here? They know that the streets can be dangerous places, and the whole community takes it upon itself to know who the children are and to, in fact, watch over them. The streets are the places where kids play. What's more is, we played interesting games when I was a kid, as opposed to suburban life, which is boring. And I say boring in the fullest sense of the word. My son and my daughter had to grow up in the suburbs. My wife insisted that we live there. I wanted to live in the city. And she said, you've got two choices. You can live in the inner city, because that's where I wanted to be. I wanted to be there like my son is living in Cincinnati, right there in the midst of the troubles and the difficulties, to be an agent of God and for change in the inner city. She said, fine, I'll move into the city. I'll live there with you. You stay home. But I'll be darned if I'm going to live in some dangerous neighborhood and be afraid to go out, and you'll be gone 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks at the time, and I'm going to be in prison there. Do you see her logic? So you've got two choices. Stay home, and I'll live where you want me to live, or move to the suburbs in a place where I can feel safe and go out. You can see her logic. And so, much to my chagrin, my wife will be here probably this afternoon for the class, but the reality is you can ask her about this, and she'll say, yes, that's right. I don't want to live where he wanted me to live if he's going to be out on the road all the time. The thing is that playing on the street was a very fun thing. The only guy that's really captured this is not a sociologist, but Bill Cosby, who grew up in West Philadelphia and loves to tell the stories of what it was like to play on the streets of Philadelphia. Did you ever hear his rip on touch football on the city streets? It's one of the funniest rips because it's the ultimate game compared with Little League in the suburbs. Little League in the suburbs. Let me describe football in the inner city. Touch football. First of all, there's an unwritten rule in the city that every kid gets to play. Every kid gets to play. You say, what about if one player is so much better than the others? Very simple. I can remember, you know, this guy was really good at the game. They would say, okay, you get Harry, the really good player, and the next guy gets to choose two players in his place. Everything was perfectly balanced. People with rule books would never do this, you know. Never do this. In the city, everybody understands. Everybody's got to play. And then the affirmation of persons in touch football in the city. You've got to watch it. They line up for touch football on the city street. Got a picture? And they have a huddle. Watch the huddles. This is what sociologists watch. Watch the huddle. The huddle takes forever. Why? Because you don't just simply call a play. You've got to affirm every person in the group. Charlie, you go out three steps, turn right, go four steps to your left, then go long. I'll fake it to you. Bill, you go up on Mrs. Jones' porch. I love the way Bill Cosby. Climb over the rail, come down, cut across the field. If you're open, I'll pass it to you. If not, I won't. Every person is get there as assignment, you know. Every role is specifically spelled out. The huddles will take forever. Now, you've got to understand what it's like to play football in the inner city. Even if they never pass the ball to you, you don't even think about it because you're going four steps to the right, five steps to the left, you're going long, and you're going to see if he's going to fake it to you. You got the picture? I mean, the affirmation, the sense of joy in playing these games, whereas in the league, in the suburbs, that you've got a coach who's intent upon winning, who yells at you if you strike out. This is ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. We have other games. Here's one that you play in the city. I love to talk about this one, stickball in Philadelphia. We played stickball. You guys, like you, Thomas, you don't even know what stickball is. And it was a universal game in West Philadelphia when I was growing up. You took a broom and you cut off the bottom part, the sweeping part, and you had a little bat, a stick ball. Then you took a tennis ball and you sliced it in half. And the pitcher threw the threw the ball, this half of a tennis ball in, and you had to hit the thing with a stick. Now, it would be hard enough to hit a regular tennis ball. You're going with a half a tennis ball, number one. Number two, because it's sliced, the air can come into the convex of the ball. You can make that thing curve like you've never seen a curve ball. And you throw that thing this way and that way, and the ball comes slicing in, and there you are at bat, and you have to swing at the thing. Got the picture? No wonder Willie Mays said, the thing that made me a great baseball player was playing stickball on the streets of New York, because you play it. Can you imagine the skill that you have to have on keeping, you know, you never have to tell the kid who's playing stickball, keep your eye on the ball. He knows how to keep the, I mean, it comes in fast, it comes in sliding slick, and you learn how to hit the thing. What's more is, how many players can you have in a game of stickball? There's no limit, do you see? Because each player is playing as an individual and keeps his own score. So it's how many runs I score, how many runs you score, how many runs you score. If there are 10 people, you're basically dealing with 10 separate teams. There's one base, just one base. It's like cricket. You hit the thing, you run to the one base and run back to home. That's it. How many runs can you get? And so you hit that thing, and you run back and forth and back and forth, and, you know, and each player gets his turn. Do we care whether Josh, who can't catch a ball for love nor money, is on the team? No. It only means he's going to end up, what, in last place. And that's pretty good if you're not too good. You'd like to have Josh play the game. Why? Because you'll feel pretty good about it, you know, when it's all over. See? Now, here's the thing. Josh will play the game, and he will be out there. And it won't make any difference that he can't catch this little half a tennis ball, because if the thing goes out, everybody knows that Josh can't catch. And the minute it goes in his direction, somebody's going to run over, I hate to say it, Josh, and push you out of the way and grab the ball and say, gee, I hope I didn't upset you. You know, apologize for this. But the game is wonderful. Note, nobody gets left out. Go and see a Little League game and watch what happens on the bench. Watch what happens with the, and there are no parents around. There are no parents around. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. Basketball is the same way. There's a little playground at 58th I guess it's Ray Street. No, it's not one Callahill, 58th and Callahill. Called Huntington Boys Club. It's just a building and three outdoor basketball courts. USA Today did a major story in the sports section on this little place where I used to play when I was a kid. 10 NBA players came off of those courts. And you say, oh man, they must have had great coaching. Not at all. Not at all. Incidentally, I'll start talking about Wilt Chamberlain, Wayne Hightower. I could go down Chink Scott. It goes on and on. Al Greer all came from these places. Tom Gola. I mean, it's one after the other of these All-American and people went on to the pros who played on this court. Let me tell you how the thing worked. You showed up to play, and you say, and your team. You didn't have a team. Teams were organized in a accord with when you showed up. So here are some guys waiting. There's three guys waiting. They're not going to get to play until what? Until two more guys show up. And they wait and wait. I guarantee you, I am 73 years old. I can still play the game, but not very well at 73. I'm not very good at rebounding. Well, I'm not very good. I mean, there's a lot of things. I can still shoot pretty well. That doesn't leave you. As a matter of fact, you get better as you get older. Be this as it may, if I went down to Haddington Boys Club today, 73 years old, and walked onto the place and say, hey guys, I want to play, there'd be three black guys here who would look at me with sheer disgust and say, all right. And I would be on their team. And when the fifth guy came, then we would be a team. I'm not sure that they would pass the ball very well to me. I don't think they trust me very well. It would be, as we call for people like myself, we used to joke and say, he's one of those guys that plays the give and go game. Give me the ball and you go for the rebound. You know, we used to say this. But everybody gets to play. There is, and you never, ever sit on the bench. There's five to a team. And you go out and play. And if you win, another team comes up and plays against you. And if you win, you stay on the court. The thing is to stay on the court as long as you can, because there are at least 10 groups of five waiting for you. If you go to a Philadelphia outdoor court, you'll see these guys sitting there waiting for their turn. Needless to say, when you get on the court, it's going to be blood. Because if your team loses, you're going to be sitting for the next hour waiting for your next chance to play. So if you ever play city basketball in Philadelphia, be sure that you are going to get beaten up. And they always note this in college basketball. He comes off the streets of the city. They are violent. When I went to Eastern, this is no longer the case, but I played on the team, and my wife will tell you, for many, many years, I held the record in the division of basketball that our college was located in for the most fouls committed in a single season. I held a record of fouling out of 27 games in a row that stretched over two seasons. I didn't know how to play the game any other way, because remember, there's no referee, do you see? So if a guy's going in for a layup that you know he's going to make, see, if you're playing with a referee, You don't push him, because after all, if you push him, what? Eventually you foul out. And number two is he gets two foul shots. So you see somebody going in for a basket, you don't do anything. On the court, if somebody's going in for a basket and there's no referee and there's a foul committed, you know what you get to do? What do you get to do? Does anybody know city ball? If you're fouled, what do you get to do? You get to take the ball out. That's it. You fouled me. Okay, take the ball out. So needless to say, if a guy's going in for a layup and it's a sure thing, what are you going to do?
Take him out.
You shove him, man. And you say, okay, take the ball out. Needless to say, two things happen. Number one is you learn to shoot jump shots from the outside. And number two is when you do drive into the basket, you learn how to maintain your balance, even though you're being pushed and shoved, which is why city ball players can play in the NBA better than anybody else, because it's rough and tumble and they get banged and they get battered. But hey, I grew up in the city. I know what it's like to go in for a basket and get five guys hitting on me and pushing me in, even as I'm going in. Whereas you get a kid that grows up in the suburbs and he goes into the basket and you give him a little shove, and my goodness, he's all upset. You shoved me. Now I missed the shot. What's the matter with you? Why didn't you make the shot? You bumped me. Of course I bumped you. You know? And of course, when I came to college, I had a very hard time, because I would bump people going in for shots, and they would call a foul. And I didn't see that I didn't. I mean, a foul in the city is when you when you really haul off and punch the guy out. I mean, to bump a guy, that's nothing. But you need to go in and see these games in the inner city at a place like Haddington Boys Club during the summer. In New York City, in Greenwich Village, there's this one place, I think it's on 8th Avenue, where they show it on films all the time when they want to show inner city people playing basketball. I mean, it is violent. And what's more is, you could go to that court, and they've done this, in New York City, and pick five guys off the court and have them play competitively with any NBA team that's in the country. These are guys that never went to college. These are guys who are just rough and tumble. They are able to do things that you would not believe. And of course, the epitome of this was a team that came out of a playground in Harlem, known as the Harlem Globetrotters. And of course, everybody said, but they would never be able to compete in a real game. And then in 1958, somebody had this bright idea to stage a game between the champions of the NBA at that time, the Minnesota Lakers. This was before the Lakers moved to California, see, L.A. You know, you often wonder, why do they call them the Lakers out there? There's no lakes in Los Angeles. They're the Lakers because they used to be in Minnesota. And Minnesota is what? Lakes, all land, lakes all over the place. So the Lakers. So he, and they had a guy there, the first really giant guy in basketball, George Mikan, the ultimate center. And the whole team was built around Mikan. And they decided to stage a game between the L.A. Lakers, rather the Minneapolis Lakers, who had just won the NBA championship, and the Harlem Globetrotters, these guys off the streets who had never been to college, who had never... And the Lake, you know, the Lakers were beaten to pieces. The Harlem Globetrotters just... And of course, the way the Harlem Globetrotters played the Lakers made it even worse because they didn't play. Have you ever seen pictures of the Harlem Globetrotters playing? I mean, they do all of these fancy things, throw the ball up in the air, one guy taps it to another, and they do all these circus tricks. So if you want to do something that's fun for your kids, take them to see a Globetrotters game, because these guys just play these games, and the whole thing becomes ludicrous. And here they were playing against the NBA champions, and they made them look like idiots. These are great ball players, you see. It's city ball. It's a whole other ball game. Two players from the golden era of Eastern, when we were taking basketball seriously, went to play for the Washington Capitals against the Harlem Globetrotters. And it was always good to go to a Harlem Globetrotters training, because when they announced the players, they would say, Steve Curl, Eastern College. And, you know, gee, I said, that little school out there playing in the big time. But it was a magnificent kind of playing on the streets. And you see, many sociologists are saying, what happens to urban planners is they come in and they don't see this rich, exciting, vibrant life of kids on the city streets. They don't see this. And all they say is these poor children, they have to play on the streets. We love playing on the streets. We love playing basketball. And not only are we good at basketball, but you know what's true in the poor neighborhood? We can't even afford a rim. Now, I want you to look around North Philadelphia and see how many outdoor courts that look like this. There is no court. The street. You play on the street, and there's a pole, and they tack up a milk carton, milk bag, you know, one of those things. Have you ever seen that? They're square. Please understand, to get the ball through that hoop, it's not even a hoop, this box, requires development of an accuracy that is unparalleled. Do you understand why city kids become great shooters on the basketball court? I mean, you give them a rim, you're asking them to put the ball into a huge basket. They've never seen anything that big before. It's a wonderful, rich, exciting life. I often tell the story when I'm talking at one particular point about when I was a boy and the cops always come and chase you because you're blocking traffic. I mean, you got these guys playing out in the middle of the street, and the cars are honking their horns because they can't get through. And so inevitably, the cops come. And they chase you, but more than that, they go after the kid with the stick. And they take the stick. Because that ends the game. And I always love to talk about the fact that one day we were sitting on the steps of this one lady's house, and we were all talking together. And I said to my best friend, Mush, we can't play stickball. Nobody's got a stick. We knew where they were. 55th and Pine Street, there was a police station. And in the back room, they put all the stuff that they ever took from people in that back room. You say, how do you know what was in the police station? I won't go into that. But I knew, everybody knew what was in our neighborhood, knew what was in the police station. And I remember saying to Mush, somebody ought to go into that police station and get in that back room and steal back 4 or 5 sticks. And Mush said, I dare you. Not in the inner city. You never say that without it being a very serious challenge. I mean, it's like the medieval days when somebody challenges you to a duel. You cannot back off. I mean, it's too late. And I said, okay, I'll do it. But you guys have got to help me. You go in and we'll pretend we have to do term papers for school. Remember where I am, in a Jewish neighborhood. And I want you to all interview the cops that you see around in the station. Each of you pick on one of them and really get into it and ask them questions intensely. I want you to go in with tablets and pencils, and while you've got those cops engaged, I will sneak into the back room and I will come out with four sticks, or I won't come out at all. And I sneaked into the back, just like I said I would, while these kids had the cops engaged in discussion. And I got four sticks. And bending low, because I remember the big desk. The cops were behind the desk here that was elevated. People are brought in. You've probably seen these scenes where they kind of process them. They were all up here. So going low along the floor, I was able to go in and out undetected, and I got the four sticks, and I sneaked out, and students hear me. The name Tony Campolo is still legend on the streets of Philadelphia. The guy that robbed the police station is standing before you today. You think it's a thrill to go to Disneyland? You think it's wonderful and exciting to go on a roller coaster at Magic Mountain? You think it gets your adrenaline high when you go on those wild rides? You don't know what it is to have an adrenaline rush until you've robbed a police station. And these are the fun things of the city. I mean, we don't get the imagery of this rich urban life. People like, here's a name, Lewis Wirth, grappled with this very, very heavily. What is life really like in the city? What are the dynamics that are going on here that the outside observer doesn't really notice? Let's study life in the city and find out what it's all about. Sociology, and particularly urban sociology, is absolutely fascinating. Why would you want to study anything else when you could study stickball and basketball games on playgrounds and watch how people who accept one another? Bill Cosby, listen to Bill Cosby's record, because all of his humor is simply built around describing his boyhood. You know, he describes it in great length. Talks about the kid that was on the team, that he had to have on the team, who was big and fat. The kid weighed 300 pounds, but you still had to put it. If he showed up, he had to be on a team. You don't just let a kid like that say, "I'm sorry, I don't think you made the team." That's suburban life. Urban life is very, very different. We don't have adults running our lives. And kids are kinder to each other than, in fact, parents are, who pretend to be kind to each other, but are really carrying on their competitive, laissez-faire, capitalistic values into the city, into the playground. That's what they're doing. I mean, they're there. They're competitors. They want to come out number one. Kids, you know, big deal. So you got a little bit of the taste of that. Parks, Olmsted. Now, in addition to knowing about Olmsted, you also need to know, I want to say a few things more about New York before I go on. The financial district of New York is known as what?
Wall Street.
Do you know why they call it Wall Street?
It's the name of the street.
Not only because of the name of the street, but why was it named? There was a wall there. That in reality, when New York was first founded, it was at the bottom tip of Manhattan, and there was a wall there to keep the people who lived in New York from being attacked by Native American Indians. And there was a wall there. And little by little, they move beyond the wall. Of course, this makes it very much like a medieval town, doesn't it? You build a wall to keep the barbarians out, to protect the people who live there. And it expanded outward. So that's in the area. If you go to New York, there are a lot of natural areas and a lot of natural zones that you should note. Because if you go to New York, then one of the things of this course is to make you into people who can be tour guides in the city and explain things to people who hadn't noticed them before. One of the things that you can do, and this is very important, is take people on a tour of New York. Chinatown is an incredible place. It's an incredible place because it takes up 9 small city blocks. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese people live in this community. When the studies were first done by the University of Chicago people who went to New York to study it, they found that most of the people, I don't know the exact figure, it was somewhere around 60 or 70% of the people living in Chinatown, in a given year, never leave that 9-block area. They do their shopping there, they go to church there, they do everything within that 9. They never venture out of that area. You talk about a city within a city, Chinatown was exactly that. You can go to Chinatown and you'll see that it's still there. Now, Chinatown moves north from Wall Street. It moves north to Wall Street until you get to a street that looks like you ought to say it's Houston, because it's spelled like Houston. Here's the difference between somebody who comes from Pittsburgh and somebody who lives in New York. You're going to look at the sign and say, oh, that's Houston Street. And they're going to say, it's Houston. It's Houston. Incidentally, Houston is absolutely wonderful. If you go all the way to the end of Houston, right near East River, there's my favorite delicatessen, and it's been at least 50 different movies because it's the epitome of New York delicatessens. It's called Katz's. Be sure to go to Katz's. Have you been there? And it's wild. You go in there, and you line up. They serve these incredible corned beef and pastrami sandwiches, and there's a big sign behind the counter that says, no tipping allowed. I guarantee you. The guy looks and says, you're looking at the sign. Do you want meat on this or don't you want meat on this? Because if you want meat on this, you better give me a tip. You know, I mean, and he's waiting on people. And you get some poor kids. I always love to do this. When I taught sociology here on a regular basis, I would always take my students to New York. And they come from these nice rural communities on upper New York State. And you go to Katz, and they'd line up, see, because the place is packed, to get sandwiches. And we're going to have lunch at Katz's, and they line up. And you get up there, and if you hesitate for one moment, just one moment, hey, what do you think? I got all day here. Come on, what do you want? If you don't know what you want, get out of line, let somebody else. And they get yelled at. And you see these poor people kind of crumbling, going, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, everybody. It's a mind boggler. It's a mind boggler. And but up to Houston Street, a little further south, is Chinatown. When you cross Houston Street in New York City, you enter into Little Italy. And it's a very small area, but very intense, with all of these Italian restaurants. And once again, you'll see, if you walk around there, you'll say, I recognize this place. Of course, it's been in 100 movies. Because that's where the mafia would hang out in New York City, in Little Italy. Please note, mafia is big business. Agreed? We're dealing with multi-million dollar operations. The question is, do the mafia dons have offices? Of course not. Well, where do they do business? In restaurants. And you'll see that they always sit with their, it's like the Wild West. You sit in the corner with your back to the wall so you can see who's coming and who's going, you see. And that's where it all takes place. Restaurants become, you know, just as the Union League served as the place of commerce for the Philadelphia elite, so it is that restaurants in Little Italy serve as office places for the mafia. You say, what are you getting into? This is what Lewis Wirth was interested in. He wasn't interested in natural zones. He wasn't interested in architecture. He was interested in what is life like in the city? What goes on there? Further on down Houston, you can go a little north and you'll come into Greenwich Village. Greenwich Village is not much anymore. When I was a kid, it was great. It was great. And if you went into Greenwich Village, you would find that there were huge numbers of Italians that lived here because it was really part of Little Italy. But it was also known as the place where the hippies, the counterculture people, lived. I mean, you know, when you talked about Greenwich Village in those days, you didn't think of Italians. You thought of these other people. But if you went up to Greenwich Village, and this is one of the studies coming out of the University of Chicago, and interviewed the people who were Italians, you say, who lives here? They would say, Italians. And then you look around, and you would see there were a lot of Italians. For instance, there were certain coffee shops filled with Italians. Anybody else live here? No. This is south of Washington Square, north of Houston. You're into Greenwich Village. No. Point being, the hippies became invisible to the Italians. You don't see what you don't want to see. Good example of this. I mean, you can't help if you walk through Greenwich Village in those days, and to some extent still true, without seeing that they were equally distributed. Hippies on the one hand, Italians on the other. Did the hippies ever see the Italians? Interview these people. Who else lives here? Well, I don't know. Everybody here is kind of counterculture. Counterculture. You got a bunch of Italians who are maintaining the village life of Italy. I mean, and the whole cultural system of an Italian village is replicated in New York City. And these hippies don't see them, and the Italians don't see them. They become invisible to each other. Worth was fascinated with this kind of a phenomena, the way in which certain groups of people become invisible to other groups of people in an urban situation. I'll tell you what he really became fascinated with. He went up to the Upper East Side, not too far up, maybe around 70, I think it was 72nd in Lexington. And there was a tall building there. And what he did, this is where sociology gets fascinating. I mean, people who are doing statistical studies bore me. And that's why the American Sociological Review is boring, because it's all that kind of stuff, because they can't do the kind of stuff that Worth did. He put a video, he had a camera up there, in those days a movie camera. And he made a movie over a 10-hour period of people crossing the streets at 52nd in Lexington, 72nd in Lexington. You say, what's going on? Because you've got to admit something weird is happening here. Because at rush hour, literally hundreds of people on their way to work or on both sides of the street, and you can't cross the street like you can in other places until the light changes. Not because you're afraid of breaking the law, but because the taxi cabs are running up and down that street so fast you'll get killed. So people stand there until the light changes, and the group gets large, and the lights are long, and the group gets larger and larger and larger until you got about 50 people over here on this side of the street. On the other side of the street, you have another 50 people. The lights change. Now, this is drama. This is what you don't see. This is what sociologists say. I'm fascinated by this. 50 people over here move towards 50 people over here. Got the picture? They're moving towards each other. And they move through each other, and they never bump. How is this possible? How can 50 people, I mean, the NFL would like to study this. How do 50 people, and the answer is, the NFL did study this. The worst studies were introduced to the coaches of the NFL. Why? As they studied this in depth, they realized that people unconsciously give eye signals to each other. So if I'm coming at you, my eyes send a message to you as to which way I want to pass you. Your eyes send a message to me of which way you're going to pass me. So as we approach each other, it looks like we're going to hit each other, but the last moment, I go right, you go left. How did we know to make those moves? The eyes communicated that. So if you talk about football players, especially linemen, what do they do now? They watch the quarterback's eyes. He can't help himself. They know who he's going to pass to. They watch his eyes. And the quarterback, on the other hand, has learned to read the eyes of the defense. Every once in a while, they'll line up, they're ready to go, and they'll say, timeout. He read something in the eyes of the defense. It's going to be a blitz. And we called a play that would make us very vulnerable to a blitz. Let's do. Incidentally, play is very important. And once again, I look to comedians to really understand the American society. George Carlin talks about football as being an American sport as opposed to soccer, because football represents the American value system. One team is trying to do what America did to the Native Americans. We want to go in the game from here, we'll even use the language, from coast to coast, little by little, taking land away from others, right? We're taking territory away from others as we move from coast to coast. Is that American? And in case you don't think it's militaristic, just think of the calls. We have a blitz. If the guy quarterback's going to throw a long pass, he calls it a what? A bomb. I mean, we could go through the whole game that way. I told you about the way in racism plays itself out in football, with the quarterback in most cases being a white guy and the people that do the running and the jumping and the power stuff, black guys, how all the American story gets played out on the football field. Games are not what they appear to be. Sociologists become fascinated. There's a whole era in the sociology of sports. You can get a PhD in the sociology of sports. What does the sport tell you about what's going on in this society? Very, very important. Very, very important.